to these public inquiries seek to find people who appear to be uncommitted and have the so-called open mind.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's all this terrible business about the statutory woman and the statutory Welshman and the statutory nonconformist, and they seek to make a sort of balance. And sometimes this results in coming up with extremely useful and good people, and only too frequently it results in the real experts, and above all, the initiator of the whole thing being left out. And quite frankly, even you too much, you care too much for their taste. And that was why she was left off. I mean, the women on the commission, in the same of myself, Lady Ogilvie, anyway, I've got the names in the other room. I mean, we were complete novices in the field compared to Eva. And, but this happens over and over and over again. It's just a fact of British public life.
So how did you know she wished she'd gone? She said so.
Oh, yes, because, of course, it was quite exciting when she was writing the paperback. I call it the paperback with the population. Then one heard that there was government interest in the warnings and findings that she set forth. And then, of course, came the news that there was to be a royal commission. And this, of course, was very, very distinguished and exciting. And really, one felt that her ideas had reached high places. And then one really rather assumed, and I don't know to what extent she did, but I did, that she clearly would be, I mean, she was the architect, the intellectual architect of it, that she would be on it. And then when the names came out, she wasn't. I mean, you know, one had many conversations about it. It was very, very painful, and it's an experience that I've had on many occasions.
So then she responded constructively to that situation and said,
I think one could call it a mutual response. I said, well, look, you are going to be quite invaluable to me, and I shall regard myself as in a sense your voice piece, although not announcing myself as such. If you're willing to, as it were, teach me and go through it with me, and she was, you know, being the sort of generous person she was, she said, yes, of course, well, I mean, that's fine. In any case, it was an opportunity in a way for her to get in on the ground floor.
So you really told her everything that was going on, did you?
Very much, yes. I shared a lot of it with her.
So how did you say, she said about briefing you, so to speak, I mean, did you have long discussions where you asked her questions?
Yes, I used to go over there, so, with the papers. It has to be said that they interrupted years, because it was all through the Blitz, and with a young family, I wasn't always based in London, although I did spend most of the war in London. And she was away for certain periods. But once, from 45 onwards, when the commission was reaching its findings, then I just simply used to go over and have supper with her at Wildbath Road in the garden suburb, and we used to just sort of go through it together. I have very keen memories of that.
And how was she as an instructress, so to speak, if one can use that word? Did she sort of put you into the picture and brief you in an effective way, do you think?
Oh yes, she had a great. I mean, she wouldn't have been principal of Morley College if she hadn't had a considerable gift for teaching, for setting things forth, for inspiration, for clarity, for vitalizing any issue. She was humorous too. It was all lit up with little sallies and jokes and things. So that, you know, she was. She was the most undreary instructress that one could ever imagine.
Anyway, she really did brief you then, and you did feel at one with her in your ideas.
Yes, oh, she wouldn't have persuaded me of anything that I didn't think, but she carried my thinking further than I probably would have carried it for myself. And she was so deeply interested in, I remember her telegram when my eldest son was born saying, do congratulate Peter on his choice of parents. You know, she had this wonderful gift of sort of identifying with the young and with people at a different stage of life from her own. You know.
That's interesting. But anyway, what ideas really do you think was she particularly anxious to get represented on the Royal Commission? And what, just really the ideas are in her book?
Yes, yes, I think that was her confessor of the day. The book that she wrote on it. But I think as we saw in the her criticisms of the commission, I think she felt that she had failed to get across the joys and satisfactions of family life, which in a sense she herself had been deprived of. And of course one has to remember that she came from a very aristocratic, long, distinguished Jewish family whose ramifications spread throughout Europe. I mean, I don't know whether you've read Diana's The cedar tree, the
yes.
Incense tree,
yes,
which is also very much part of Eva's background.
Yes.
So this concept of family life, I mean, I suppose one could say that she obviously had never at any stage of her life experienced the problems of poverty and shortage of money and shortage of material. Or indeed the shortage of domestic help. I mean, Diana refers to her sitting around with the grandchildren and being involved with the grandchildren, but she always had domestic help, and said that in a sense, rather like the Webbs and Virginia Woolf and other people of her, educated women of her generation, the problems that my generation faced, in a sense we were the sort of bridge generation, because I grew up in a home in which I never even made my bed, and when I first married I couldn't work out why the gong didn't ring and the meals didn't just appear. And then one moved rapidly into a phase, of family life with very little, if any, domestic help. But she was of that generation.
So she never had the personal family difficulties of arranging your day, sort of thing.
No, she never had to decide how much to give. She never had to take three children to school, come back and do the washing, see to the shopping, see there was a meal in the evening, and find time for her work. I mean, those aspects were dealt with, so that she wasn't.
Could I just ask you? You must have been to her house quite a lot. How did she run her house? What sort of impressions of the house do you remember, really?
I think one would say that it was a house of great charm and not very great comfort. There were these lovely grey slate Cornish floors. There was no central heating, of course. There was a great wood fire that was lovely, and a marvellously pretty peacock, very, very Ruskin, peacock coloured tiles around the fire. Shells, rush mats, gentle colours, and lovely pictures.
She obviously taken care about.
She was very, very visually conscious. She wasn't a sybarite in any sense. She wasn't interested in physical comfort, but she was greatly interested in beauty. My own background was very much sort of low living and high thinking. And in a sense, she was very much a reflection of that. She came from a much richer part of the community, in a sense. But she was uninterested, because I've been close friends, really, for many, many years with the daughter-in-law, who, as you know, is Jennifer's sister, married the youngest son.
Yes.
And Julia Hubbock lives in Amsterdam. She, for years, wanted her husband to move. They lived in three ways, inherited it from Eva, and I used constantly to go over there in Julia's day, and she was always complaining about how cold it was and how uncomfortable it was. would say that I saw, as it were, my generation's attitude towards what had been Eva's great pride and joy. Of course, it was an enormous house, that has to be said, too.
Well, how was it kept, actually? Was it a well-kept house?
It was immaculate. I mean, there were always two living in domestics, you see. There was always the cook and the parlour maid. I'm not sure towards the very end whether there were still the two. But, of course, one of the features of those days, and in a sense, I'm always interested in this because my mother very much broke away from it in building our family home in the Isle of Wight, was that the kitchen quarters were always perfectly revolting. And it was always assumed that that these domestics could sleep in very small bedrooms and could always have a kitchen which never had any outlook at all. I mean, I remember my grandparents in the Isle of Wight put frosted glass in the kitchen window so that not only could people not see in, but they couldn't see out. And I mean, this, you know, that was one of the daughter-in-law's moments. Of course, spending much more of her time in the kitchen was how uncomfortable the kitchen was.
Yes, I understand. What about looks? I mean, was she a motherly sort of figure to look at?
Yes, she was rather like Winifred, rather overweight. And she was, I don't think she believed very much in sort of foundation garments or anything that was very restrictive. She liked sort of loose flowing, comfortable clothes. And of course, being as active as she was, she needed it to be that way. And she was in a sense, a very motherly figure. Except that sometimes that unhappily has a connotation of somebody not being tremendously bright, and of course she was tremendously bright. She was very large, very floppy, very soft, but at the same time she was very, very, very alive, interesting, amusing.
Incisive as well.
Oh yes, and had a very dry wit and quite a cutting edge at times.
Were her ideas on the Royal Commission? Songs she'd written, were they discussed much in the commission? And what was the attitude to her inside the commission, if there was one?
She was regarded as an individual who had certain attitudes, and she gave individual evidence to the commission. What I can't now recall was whether she gave personal oral evidence. She certainly gave written evidence. You probably could find it.
There was no sort of opposition to her ideas inside the commission. It was just that she wasn't asked, that's all.
Yeah, yes, that's right. I think I wouldn't like to use the word extremist, but if you think that the first chairman was Sir John Simon, later Lord Simon,
yes,
who at the very first meeting introduced us to each other by saying, that we are drawn here together today, almost as if he was sort of introducing a prayer meeting, to consider this very grave problem of the falling birth rate. He didn't say the middle class falling birth rate, but he said the falling birth rate and the falling size of family. I must tell you that my personal view, he said, is that this is largely due to the fact that women no longer use the old-fashioned form of the prayer book service to love, honour and obey. I, of course, being a young woman, simply didn't know where to put myself. I didn't know whether it was supposed to be a joke. I think I managed not to laugh. But this was said in all seriousness. So this was the climate, you see. This was the sort of consensus. And therefore, Eva was regarded as a sort of distant peak of something.
It's really interesting that.
I was always told he was exceptionally devoted to his mother.
Yeah.
But
he didn't give the impression of that.
I can only say that he did actually use this phrase, and it was rather amazing.
But did Eva, you presumably then said, well, so and so saying so and so to the commissioner, we found out this, or the opinion's moving this way. Did you then encourage her? Did she then respond and sort of say, well, I'll give you information to knock him on the head or her on the head or whatever it might be? And did she act in that way?
Yes, she would. I mean, I can't quote you chapter and verse, but I mean, when we went through the minutes, for example, or were any new papers that were being presented to us. You see, we had this whole series of technical subcommittees who were very high-powered people, medical and scientific and so on. And then she would say, well, look, why don't you raise this and say that? I mean, she was always sort of pushing the frontiers forward again in discussion. And of course, she was, her great focus of concern in a way was, you could almost say psychological, emotional, is people's attitude towards it, and how could this climate of opinion be affected? I mean, she would have, I don't know how she would have been in today's climate of the Child Poverty Action Group and the tremendous concentration on the financial and economic aspects.
She liked children, did she?
Yes, she wasn't somebody who, and I've known many people who were good with children on paper. I mean, she genuinely was amused by and nice to and fond of children. It has to be said that given her age and generation, she never had the full-time, night-time, day-after-day care of children in any circumstances. And of course, her own children were, she had her mother with all the going household in Cambridge Square, who was a tremendous support. And of course, in any case, being a widow, she had full-time work from a very early point in her own young family's growth. But one could say that she was very interested in children, and children liked her.
So in a way, these servants and so on enable her to reconcile the two roles of mother and public worker, in a sense.
Oh, yes, yes. There wasn't a sort of conflict for her that there was for succeeding generations. I mean, she didn't have my problems of racing home through the tube to get home 5 minutes before the children came in from school. And once I got in to hear one of my twins, who was about nine at the time, saying, "No, Mummy's not in. I think she's at a meeting giving a lecture about the importance of mothers being at home when their children get home from school." She didn't have any of these sort of amazing conflicts.
How did she actually respond to the war? I suppose one of the big questions, you didn't know her during that period. What did she sort of bear up during the war in a rather heroic way? Somebody told me that she was, if anybody had only 2 inches of water in their bath, it would be Eva.
Yes, I think every sort of patriotic demand and so on that was made, she would go one better. I don't think one can exaggerate the tragedy of the Second War for these First World War widows. And, I mean, I saw it in my own family where my three uncles were all killed in the First War. My father's whole work, of course, was devoted to his great motivation for the League. And, I mean, our breakfast table, I mean, talk about, what was it that they said, that the Red Sea flowed through Anthony Eden's drawing room. I mean, Abyssinia and Manchuria, and these things were our absolute sort of breakfast table conversation. And when Germany left the League in 1933, everyone had this fearful feeling of here it comes again. I mean, for those of us who were young children in the First War, the coming of the Second War was something of quite unspeakable horror. And of course, when you are in touch with Sheila Grant Duff, as I hope you will be, she will tell you that her mother, who was widowed in the First War, her father was a very distinguished army officer, killed riding a white horse leading his troops in 1914, and her only brother was killed in the Second War. Mrs. Grant Duff, actually went to France and saw Goering, and went to Germany and saw Goering, so that, I mean, you know, but I can't really quote a chapter and verse of Eva's.
Anyway, she was very patriotic in the war effort and did her bit, you know.
In every possible sense.
But one thing puzzles me, Mr. Jay, and that is this, that if Eva was had such an easy access to the commission by you, why didn't the commission actually take her point about the spiritual attractions of having children and so on?
Well, I think the answer to that really is that the report, that the findings of any group of people series of points of view. And I, after all, may well have been a lone voice trying to put forward these points. And of course, there was always the counterattack. It's all very well for you. You know where your next meal's coming from. You've got a secure roof over your head. You've just had your twins. You're enjoying your young family. But that's because you have got financial security. What about those who don't? And of course, as a social, as a member of the Labour Party myself, I was particularly vulnerable to this kind of riposte.
So her view was represented in the commission, but it wasn't as dominant as she would like.
No, this is the best. This is the right way of putting it.
But she was also on the LCC later, wasn't she? Were you on the LCC with her?
Oh, yes, I was. But the funny thing is that I have absolutely no memories of her at the LCC. She was co-opted onto the Education Committee, and I was a member of the Education Committee from 1938 to 1967, for 30 years. And yet Eva's presence there, I can't recall. I think it was that she was there largely in the war and immediate post-war years, and I had got, and the LCC was very much packed up. We didn't have formal meetings. The few meetings we had were sort of in sandbags in the basement, with sandbags in the basement. And I was very much preoccupied in that particular time with the birth of the twins in 45, and it may be that times that she was attending very regularly, I was less regular, but I just don't have a memory of her there, although we were both members of it. I mean, I later was chairman of the schools committee and was very much involved with it all, but by that time, it was after her left.
Yes, yes. Did you ever have any feeling about how she brought up her children? Because they weren't really children by the time you were in high school. Well, they were, yes, of course they were. They were your contemporaries. I mean, did she see enough of her children? What she,
well, this is, I don't know to what extent, I wouldn't, do you think should I speak to
them? It's really entirely up to you. I mean, I can switch off if you wish. I mean, this won't go back to any of the children, if that's...
No, and I mean, in your final way that you decide to write it, you may well take what I now intend to say into account, but don't let you have to sign it, so to speak.
No,
I think that that her, all her children suffered a very real deprivation, a very real sadness in some sense, a very real sense of loss. Now, whether this was due to the death of the father, or whether it was because as infants they didn't really have a close and continuous relationship with her, but I, as I've always understood it, really were brought up by nannies and grandmothers and people. Diana was always a tortured person, given great digit depression. And there's no, and of course she, Diana had nervous breakdown, Rachel had nervous breakdown, Diana's son is a lifelong schizophrenic. And there is I don't now hardly recall whether it comes through the Spielmans or through the Hubbock side, but from the point of view of the next generation, there isn't an altogether 100% inheritance aspect there. Of course, I expect you know now about, what's it, was his Christian name, Eva's husband?
Can't remember offhand. I mean, you're being very frank with me, I can be frank with you about the family in which I can't be with them, actually.
Yeah, of course.
But I have the impression, I don't know who it was who told me, but that the marriage wasn't actually terribly happy.
No, it was really quite a disaster, but I've never been able to absolutely pin down. I mean, sometimes it was rather put to me that one of the problems was a great difference of social class and so on. But I don't really think this can be right. Hubbock's... Well, this again, I had never heard. Could be. Now, what is very interesting to me about Hubbock's family history is that, of course, he is directly descended from Jane Austen.
Yes, and that always interests me very much. And Diane Mishforce has been writing something about Jane Austen. Yes, all that, and all those famous naval brothers of Jane Austen and all that. So quite an interesting background, but it was not, it has to be said that it was not happy.
No, I didn't think it was. But, I mean, you surprised me about the children, because they don't, I've met all three, and I agree with you about Diana being taught. You could tell that from the biography in a way, and the way she writes her own autobiography. But Ruth seemed to be entirely...
Rachel.
Rachel, was it? Yes, the entirely sort of stable and the easy person that I have heard that she had problems with.
Yes, she did very much. She has come through very much, Rachel. Mm-hmm. I think you could say that David was the most rock-solid, stable... I don't know whether you've met David, have you?
Yes.
Well, that's right. Well, I think he's super David, and I think it could be that he had a very particular warmth and welcome because he was a boy. I think that there may be that she longed for a son. I think he must have been born practically at the time of his father's death. But I don't know whether his early experience was a sort of happier one than the girls, or whatever.
Maybe
knows.
He, you say, is schizophrenic.
No, his son.
Oh, his son.
No. Let's get this right. Diana's eldest, Tom. Diana's eldest. That is Eva's grandson. Is a absolutely crook, and never is living in and out of a mental hospital all the time. Absolutely tragic. I'm supposed to be his godmother, so you can imagine how sort of sense of guilt I have about that. No, they had some bother with, David had some bother with his youngest, again a boy, but that's all perfectly resolved itself.
But you can't, it's very difficult to explain this sort of thing, isn't it? But you can't really say that that's due to Eva's upbringing of her children in any sense. It's a hereditary thing to some extent.
Well, it's always this issue, isn't it, of inheritance and environment. I think that...
I had the impression Diana was a bit neglected, actually, as a school child, and felt so, and actually said so.
Well, I think it comes through. I mean, I think if you are altogether based in your grandmother's house and your mother lives elsewhere and is tremendously preoccupied with her work, I think Diana's... Do cats upset you?
No.
Okay. I think there's no doubt that Diana did feel neglected. There's absolutely no doubt. I would guess as an infant and as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's splendid. No, that really does clarify things a lot. One other thing I want to ask you, do you think her Jewishness was important, really? Because, of course, she wasn't a practicing Jew in the sense of religion, was she, by the time you knew her? Do you think her Jewishness is related to her interest in the whole population question?
I would think that the Jewishness came through in her sense of family, her concern for the family. She was tremendously un-Jewish. I mean, many of her attributes, to me, coming from what was in origin a non-conformist home on my father's side, Congregationalist, and a Quaker home on my mother's side, she was, to me, the very epitome of a true Christian, which was so fascinating. I mean, her humility, her unselfishness, her public spirit. But in a way, I think Diana was much more concerned with her Jewishness, which was after all only 50%. And what was that phrase in Diana's book? What is the word they use, Jewish people, for a child who's a mitzing? Or a,
yes, I can't.
Do you remember this particular phrase, if you're half Jewish and half not?
Yeah.
But no, I would think that Eva was in a sense very much liberated from a great deal of it. And of course, when one thinks of the Spielman household as compared with the Eva's home, I mean, they were about a century apart, really. I mean, the grandparents were still living in the Galsworthy days, really.
Yes, it's fascinating. Set up the whole Spielman set up, actually. Winifred's written a really good book about her.
it's quite, yeah, isn't it? And all the European ramifications.
Yes. But the Jewish aspect of things before the Second World War didn't seem to me to have a great effect on Eva. In other words, she wasn't taking a lot of refugees into her house or involving herself in any torture way about the way the Jews were being treated in Germany, particularly in Washington.
No, she wasn't particularly involved about the Hitler horrors. Mm-hmm. I suppose you could say that Tommy Barrog was an early refugee from Hitler. John Freeman certainly wasn't.
And that, in a way, surprised me, except because she was so busy on so many things that there just wasn't time for anything.
Well, yeah, as you say, I mean, she was stretched to the very limit with all her commitments.
Did you ever have any connection, as you see her in the context of these, what's the citizenship thing, I can't remember the name, with Paul Simon's thing, or
was it
education for citizenship?
Education for citizenship. I think I did occasionally go to sort of summer schools and things, because my father was also connected with that. World citizenship, was it called?
Education of citizenship, which is the idea of educating people in democracy.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Sort of thing.
Yes, their responsibilities as citizens and all that.
Yes.
No, I can't.
Yes,
I mean, I surfaced, as it were, as an adult much more with her population interests, which, in my own background, went back too to this eugenic interest.
Do you think, I mean, looking back now, I mean, your own career and so on, would you say you owed anything yourself in the way you behave now, your ideas or whatever, to Eva? Or was her influence at that depth on you? Or was it just a particular influence in relation to the Royal Commission on Population? That's a difficult question to answer. But,
I think the best way to put it is that I was subject, as it were, to many influences which were also Eva's influences, and in a sense the appreciation of nature, the love of the north, of North Cornwall, the seizing the moment, appreciating beauty as it passed, were things that she in a sense symbolized and focused, perhaps you could call her a sort of catalyst. But I wouldn't say that she sort of transformed my life or altered it radically onto different paths, but I would think that she did certainly bring to me great enrichment, in the sense that many of my lifelong friends are people that she introduced me to. And I think anybody that you have a deep regard for and affection for is, in a sense, a great enrichment to one. And it was very interesting how this marvelous jumping of the generations, in which I felt so much closer to her, as indeed I do to Winifred, than I did to my own contemporary in the shape of the daughter, you know.
Yes, and also, presumably you met her at a time when, I don't know, maybe you were reacting against your parents, or you were critical of your parents, and she's a sort of, in a sense, a substitute parent, perhaps. I'm just putting it rather crudely, but you know what I mean.
Yes, yes. Well, I can see that she did in some senses fit that role, and that could be said about her. Absolutely, I do.
That's really most helpful.